The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
We live in a fantastically beautiful yet interdependent world. Wherever we look in nature, we find complete harmony with the fundamental principles that govern our ecosystem. From the gleaming fish in our rivers and lakes to the flowers and the bees of the land, evidence abounds all around us that we live on a cosmic jewel that the astronauts called the Good Earth. Life as we know it is almost entirely dependent upon other forms of life. Nothing lives or dies to itself, even though sometimes we see only a part of the cycle. This total interdependency of all life is part of the remarkable design found in every facet of our environment. In a world increasingly plagued with environmental problems, words like biosphere and ecosystem and interdependency are becoming a little more commonplace. As a matter of fact, there's nothing quite so funny anymore about comedian suggestions that maybe we better get busy and go out and grow carrots or beans on the golf courses. I've said time and again, maybe we ought to all have gardens instead of front yards or backyards, and if the bottom falls out of the economy, maybe a lot of us will wish we had done something like that in advance. Looking at ecosystems, or the biosphere on which we live, and looking at the food versus population struggle of all of humankind, we're becoming more and more aware, or at least I hope we are, of our total dependency upon just good humus, dirt, the earth, the ecosphere, all around us for our own survival. It is true that nothing lives or dies to itself, that there is certain interaction between all living creatures to some greater or lesser degree. As a matter of fact, many scientists feel that there is nothing that lives that does not in some way depend upon every other thing or most other things that do live. And that certainly includes man, because we are right in the very middle of the biosphere, of the ecosystem. We stand at sea level, basically, and our populations around the world are heavier the closer you get to sea level. The higher you go up into the mountains, the fewer the people there are. You can look at the sea, and the same thing is stated of fish and of bottom-dwelling creatures. The continental shelves, the shallow oceans, bays, estuaries, rivers are teeming and abundant with fish life and crustaceans. The deeper you go, the more bizarre the forms and the fewer there are. And man finds himself right in the midst of all of this fantastic ecosystem, or biosphere, having to but put up his hand to the trees that grow above him, or dip into the oceans and the lakes and the rivers that are around him and at his feet, to be able to live. Well, in the midst of all of this is the question, how did it get started? Time and again, as I read whether novels or historical novels or whether biographies or science books or what have you, you run into the question of evolution. Whether people are moralizing about personal moral transgressions or the absence or the lack of them, about changes in society, of marriage and the like, and based upon whether or not there are living, absolute moral principles, they always talk about man as the hairless ape, man the animal, in the midst of other animals. Well, is man an animal? The questions surrounding our ecosystem, our biosphere, and the questions of interdependency get right to the root and the core of the question, what is man? And were we created and put upon this earth by an all-wise, divine creator who has intelligence that is supreme, who is God, and who gave to humankind his word that reveals to us knowledge we could not otherwise discover for ourselves? Or are we the accident of nature? Are we the caprice of the ecosystem? The closer we look at it, the more startling some of the questions become. Science simply cannot answer some of the questions about symbiosis, that is, the existence of one organism with another organism. There are several different types of symbiosis, and each one of these organisms designed so it performs its part flawlessly. For example, in different levels of degrees of positive interactions of how these organisms involved do their part, how they derive benefit from each other, how each is perfectly designed to perform a certain function. Now, some of them can benefit while the other may not, but in every single case, there is no lack of benefit. There is no harm. There are three levels of such interaction that scientists note. One is called commensalism, when two individuals of different species live together, and one, that is the commensal, derives benefit, with the other being neither helped nor harmed. The second is protocooperation, when two individuals of different species both gain, though each is able to survive without that given association. The third is called mutualism. And that's when two individuals of different species are so interdependent that neither can survive without the other. They can only exist depending upon this interrelationship. Commensalism is explained by several different examples, one or two of which will give you. There are thousands of examples of commensalism in nature. Commensalism really means being at table together, by the way. An interesting example of this is the pilot fish that almost always accompanies tropical sharks. The pilot fish is about a foot long, blue in color, with darker stripes along its sides. It swims along the companion shark below or at the side of its head, watching the movements of this big predator with an extraordinary precision. For a long time, pilot fish were thought to be guiding sharks to their food. Actually, what they really appear to do is feed on scraps of food from the shark's meals. Nor do they, as previously thought, attach themselves to a particular shark. On the contrary, if one shark among a group of several takes a bite at something, the pilot fish might swim away from the sharks that are not feeding and join the one that is. As for the shark, it gets no visible benefit whatever from this relationship with the pilot fish, but it tolerates its presence. The pilot fish was perfectly designed for this relationship with a shark. So that's an example of commensalism. Wherever you look in our environment, no matter what types of organisms are involved, you see design, interdependency, and intricacy, and harmony, and flawless perfection. The closer you look at nature, whether we're talking about the blade of grass, the wing of a fly, or a butterfly, whether you're talking about the way living things grow, at seeds and flowering plants and trees or vegetables, no matter what it is you look at, the crystalline properties of minerals or metals, you look at nature, the closer you look at it, the more you magnify it, the more perfection. The closer you look at what man has done, the more imperfection. Proto-cooperation is defined as being a level of relationship that means two organisms could live without each other if necessary, although their lives are made much easier by living together in harmony. As with commensalism, this type of relationship is found in great abundance in marine life in particular. An extraordinary example of this intimate relationship between brilliantly banded clownfish of the tropical coastal reef and the huge stinging sea anemones with which they live is this. The anemone is a pale, deceptively flaccid creature up to about 3 feet in diameter with a tangle of tentacles covered with batteries of stinging cells. Nearly every anemone has three, four, or even more clownfish carrying on their lives among these poisonous arms. They'll dart out on occasional feeding forays, but return always to a protective custody of this landlord of theirs. Each fish seems to know its own anemone and always returns to the same one. Sometimes a male and a female will even keep house together, raising their young, who are zealously guarded by the father until they're old enough to go out and find an anemone of their own. Which is even more surprising, though, is that each anemone seems unfailingly to recognize its own particular clownfish. Not only will it sting to death any other fish that strays into its tentacles, but it will also, believe it or not, kill any strange clownfish. So it's proved that the clownfish is susceptible to the anemone's sting. But how this anemone, a plant, is able to recognize its own inmates, or how it first came to tolerate them, nobody knows. It used to be thought that the anemone got nothing out of this relationship, but later evidence suggests that the clownfish not only brings back offerings of food for the anemone, but also acts as a decoy for other types of fish, which they lure to their doom in the tentacles. If this is so, it would be a case of mutualism, with the fish getting protection and the anemone occasional meal. But it's also possible that the association goes even further, that it involves a form of servicing arrangement whereby the anemone cleans the clownfish of minute crustaceans or fungi on its skin. In any case, the clownfish can be seen turning on their sides as they swim through the tentacles, rubbing against them in what seems to be an almost affectionate-like manner, like aquatic cats asking to be scratched. And I remember on a case of skin diving down in the Aqaba area of Eilat on the Israeli side. I've been on there a couple of times. Some fabulous coral reefs are down in the warm waters of the Red Sea. And I dove down about, 8 or 10 feet or so. And here were some beautiful clownfish and some big anemones. And I was able to swim right up and watch them. When I got close, they would dart away somewhere. The minute I backed off, they came back and huddled inside these big sea anemones. It's a very inspiring and very exciting thing to see, especially in person like that. So if you ever get a chance to go skin diving, well, stay away from the anemones. I don't know if they're poisonous to man. I doubt it. But at any rate, you'll see a creature not unlike this one. There are many, many different varieties of this one particular species called clownfish. And this booklet that we can send to you if you will call to the toll-free number or write to the address we'll give you a couple of times in a program is called Some Fishy Stories About an Unproved Theory, and that's talking about the theory of evolution. Let me show you some of the type of photography you'll get here, and also children very interested in this. A lot of people have written and told us that they've used this for class papers on the subject of evolution. Here's one of the most unusual photographs of all time of the archer fish spouting to get a fly off a limb that we did in an experiment in our own photographic laboratory. And you'll see pictures here of how that is done and some of the dilemmas of evolution. The archer fish that actually will survive, just like any other fish, by feeding at the top, on the bottom, or in the middle of the water, whatnot, and yet also will spout. A four-eyed look at evolution. A picture here, of course, is Anableth, the four-eyed fish. A great deal of colorful illustration. Here's an example. We caught the stop action of fishing without a license of the archer fish and how he captures his food with a funny-looking kind of an angleworm growing out of the top of his head. These and other examples in this Fishy Stories About an Unproved Theory you can have by return mail absolutely free of charge. So that relationship of the clownfish and the anemone is one example of a symbiotic relationship of mutualism, of how both apparently benefit, one of them most certainly does, and how did it all get started? How did this sea anemone recognize the one particular clownfish? And how does the clownfish develop, or did it develop, an immunity over a period of time when those stinging tentacles would instantly kill it? It's interesting that man is not now immune to mosquitoes and that Hebrew babies are not born circumcised, isn't it? When you stop to think about the idea that science might say, well, maybe one day a particular clownfish way back in the dim reaches of the past got stung just a little bit and gradually developed some kind of a immunity to that. Well, no, that theory is exploded immediately by the fact I gave you earlier that an other different kind of anemone that might be host to another clownfish nearby will surely sting to death one that doesn't belong to it in particular. So I don't know how people are going to rationalize their way around some of these unanswerable questions for evolution. The simplest answer is that they were designed, that they were created, that they all began doing what they are doing simultaneously. How did it begin? That's the question asked and answered in this brochure and others like it that you can have by return mail absolutely free of charge. To follow the reasoning for evolution, the creatures of the sea, of the air, the land, whether we're talking about bacteria, whether we're talking about the four-eyed fish, anableth that looks above and below the sea or the water surface at the same time to protect himself, has to face the question, how did it develop? How did it evolve? Did it happen gradually? Evolution states that all creatures that we know today, man and everything you can look at in our society, our environment rather, gradually evolved from a lesser, simpler, lower form of life. If that is so, then there had to be a step along the way where the anemone wasn't quite what it is today, and where the clownfish was not a clownfish and wasn't quite what it is today. And if that is so, it was something different. And it would have been stung to death instantly. These questions that you will see in the brochure when you write for it are rampant. There are literally thousands of them. There is a question for every single kind of creature that you can talk about. One of the next, then, of these three levels of this symbiotic relationship is that of proto-cooperation. It's found among terrestrial animals as well. Mutualism is the most intimate level, though, of these positive interactions. Neither organism can survive in the case of mutualism without the other. One of the best and the most oft-used examples of this type of relationship where neither can survive without the other is that of the termites. Termites, like ants, work together in a very complex and orderly society. In fact, a lot of people might wish they were a little less organized. These often troublesome wood eaters allow whole colonies of one-celled animals called protozoa to live in their stomachs. The newborn termites do not have their own complement of protozoa at birth, but they're soon infected with a supply from the older termites. Termites now can't digest wood, no matter how it looks, but protozoa, called flagellates, live inside the termites, and they digest the wood for them. The protozoa receive protection and give off a substance in return which the termite can digest. Should the flagellates die, the termite host will die too. It'll starve to death, full of wood that it couldn't digest. Hundreds of protozoa can use the eye of a needle as a swimming pool. But how did complex interdependent creatures like termites and protozoa, which cannot live apart from each other, evolve separately? And how could they have evolved together? How did termites live until they got smart and swallowed protozoa in the first place? And where were the protozoa when the cellulose-clogged termites looked for them? They couldn't have been in existence apart from the termites. The simple answer is, they were designed and created together and at the same time. There is no other way, and there's no other intelligent answer. You have to ask, as you look at the marvels of nature through the camera eye of the miracle of microscopic photography and the enlargement of some of these minute creatures we could never otherwise see with our own eyes, and to really become acquainted with the living forms and things that make up a part of our environment that are happening probably while you're sitting there right underneath your home. And then we have to ask the question, how, when, and why, and where, and who? What about intricate interdependency, design, development, harmony, beauty, and this symbiotic relationship of one creature which can't survive without the fully developed capacity of another creature even living inside of it? There are many cases of parasites and hosts, as the case of humankind itself, and the fact that we cannot digest our food properly without many helpful bacteria. Harmful bacteria are kept in check usually by the helpful bacteria. When they get out of balance because of what we do to our system, we get colds and flus and diseases and whatnot. But how did these intimate relationships evolve? That's the question. Did they evolve at all? Or were they created to begin doing what they're doing right now? And were they created instantly? Another relationship which could be used, and I won't dwell on at great length, is that of the lichens. How a lichen looks like a plant, but actually it's two plants, an alga, and a fungus living closely together. The algae, which possess chlorophyll, make food which is used by both the algae and fungi, while the fungi are thought to hold water for the algae and help anchor and hold the algae together in the association. This combination, by the way, is so well designed and successful that lichens survive where no other plant can live, in the Arctic, bare mountain rocks, the dry southwestern desert, practically anywhere. The most extraordinary example, though, of mutualism is found in the story of the common honeybee. We see them all the time in our own backyards and wherever we go. A bee colony is like a vibrant, dynamic organism. Each bee performs a duty for the benefit and the perpetuation of that whole colony, and no one honeybee can live alone. Sometimes bee colonies can have from 40 to 70,000 individuals, which makes them about as large as many of our smaller or medium-sized man-made cities. In the United States alone, it's estimated there are about 5 million such colonies, producing somewhere around 250 million pounds of beeswax. Now, there are three different types of bees, the queen, the drones, and the workers. Every colony will have one queen bee, and she's the only fully developed female in the hive, a veritable egg-laying machine, absolutely essential to the survival of the colony. During a given spring season, an efficient queen can lay up to 1,500 eggs in one day. Also present in the colony are hundreds of drones, or male bees, and their only purpose in life is to service or to fertilize the queen. The third group of bees, these in the broad majority, the workers. They're the mainstays of the hive. In reality, the unfertile females is what they are, basically neuter, unable to lay eggs. These workers care for all the bee progeny. They feed them, they nurse the young, they keep the hive clean, they make sure the temperature is constant, and they have a unique method of doing that. On a very hot day, you can hear a ferocious buzzing outside of a beehive and around it and inside of it, and you find out the workers are busily fanning with their wings to create an actual current of air over those hexagonal cells where the young bees are developing. Also, every worker bee is a portable wax-producing machine. Bees exude wax from the underside of their abdomens. And as this wax is exuded, a bee will remove the wax with its feet and knead it into a small lump, and the wax is then used to build and repair the cells. Beeswax is a really remarkable substance. It has the highest melting point of any known wax for its ductility, approximately 140 degrees Fahrenheit, and that ensures the combs will not melt even when the hive reaches 110 degrees during summer heat. Now, each one of the cells is a veritable miracle of craftsmanship. The walls, in parts, are only 2/1000ths of an inch thick, the same thickness as the diameter of the hair of your head. Yet 1 pound of comb will support at least 25 pounds of honey. Each of the side walls combine to form a regular hexagon. The hexagon is in itself a remarkable shape. It's the one geometrical shape that is close to a circle to receive the round bee larva, but yet can be close-packed without any wasted space. Octagons, for example, are even more circular in shape, but you can't close-pack them. The hexagon, thus, is the best possible shape the bee could have selected, and that's kind of a problem for evolution. There's a kind of a dance that a bee does when he comes back to the hive after he's located a source of food. Maybe it's a whole field of alfalfa, or of clover, or something. And when he comes back to the hive, he will communicate to the rest of the worker bees in that colony how far away is the source of food by stomping his feet, waving his wings, and turning around in circles. Sometimes in classes, children have an opportunity to observe bees actually doing that when they have maybe a schoolroom window hive. And if he keeps his reference as the sun and continually changing, even if he's in a hive for several minutes so the rest of the workers leave, they go toward this new source of food in this proverbial beeline because the one that just arrived back told them all about it by these gyrations and motions, and the rest of them were kind of looking and listening, and then they took off and found it. If the nectar is very close, the scout bee does a kind of a round dance. If it's a little further away, it'll be more of a lengthy procedure. It will start as a straight dance, which kind of merges into a little bit of a wiggle-waggle at the end. The others are watching this performance and pretty soon take off and find where the clover is. Another thing is the flower constant that the bees have. A group of bees in a hive can on one particular occasion limit itself to only one particular blossom in the area. Now maybe here's the farmer's field of crimson clover, for example. There may be many kinds of plants in the vicinity, but those bees will harvest only that crimson clover, and you get clover honey flavor. Such flower constancy on the part of bees is more important than the flower itself. A necessary condition, by the way, cross-pollination and so on, is kept going. And bees use the fragrance of that particular flower to memorize the smell and to guide them there. And they have a sense of smell far more developed than the most professional taster you ever heard of. They can tell a lot more about the differences, for example, between the orange peel oil produced in Spain and that produced in Sicily. Bees have, on the outstretched antenna attached to their head, a very sensitive organ of touch, kind of like a nose. And also, they have color vision. They're totally colorblind in an absolutely bright red flower, but that's all right because the bright red kind of a blossom is always pollinated by other types of insects and little hummingbirds. The bees leave them alone, and they just pollinate other types. They can see the yellows and blues and reds in mixtures, but not pure red all by itself. You can take the little honeybee for granted, but as we have seen, he's really a remarkable creature. The fascinating story, though, is that without plants and flowers, bees couldn't exist. And without the bees, most plants and flowers couldn't exist. And so you are forced to ask the question, which came first? Were bees here before the flowers? Or did flowers evolve first and then the bees? Well, as they did, the flowers only survived for that one first little bloom, and then they all died, didn't they? So any amount of reasoning shows it had to happen together simultaneously. Blossoms of flowering plants provide pollen, a source of protein needed by bees, and nectar, a source rich in sugar that is used in the manufacture of honey. So let's see some of the interesting facts about bees as they go about the business of collecting nectar and pollen. As bees visit the flowers, they suck up droplets of nectar. It passes through the long gullet into their honey sac. When the bee returns, it deposits this fluid into the honey cells. A droplet of nectar brought home by any bee is infinitesimally small. The bee's honey stomach, when it's empty, is only the size of a pinhead. It would take 50 full bee stomachs to fill only one thimble. Not only that, but a bee must visit between 1,000 and 1,500 single florets of, say, a clover blossom just to fill its stomach once. Yet in some cases, a bee colony may be able to store more than 2 pounds of honey in a single day. We ought to be more thankful than we are for the bees, because who would have the patience to collect nectar and transform it into honey? A gallon of the stuff, it's been estimated, may provide enough energy for a bee to cruise about 4 million miles. It's generally agreed that an average-sized colony of honeybees will need between 50 to 100 pounds of pollen per year. And that means bees have got to harvest between 2 to 4 million different loads of pollen. They don't swallow the pollen as they collect it, but they mold it into that solid mass attached to the outer side of their hind legs that many a schoolboy has noticed. And as the bee gathers this pollen, he becomes completely dusted with it on his body. So in the flight from flower to flower, the bee inevitably leaves some of the pollen on the stigma of the next flower to be visited. And that helps, of course, to pollinate it. Not only that, but the plants are cross-pollinated, which is absolutely essential, as you'll see, for many commercially marketable and edible foods that we humans eat. Pollen from one flower reaches another flower, the same species of plant, in what is called cross-pollination, and a healthier progeny results. Without bees, agriculture simply couldn't exist. And without growing crops, you couldn't exist. Bees handle up to 80% of all pollination done by insects. And some agriculturalists estimate that each bee is worth about $100 to American crop growers. Bees pollinate different agricultural crops, and in the United States and Canada alone, their pollination services are worth more than $3 billion annually. So the value of a honeybee is astronomical and unbelievable. There was an experiment where one branch of a pear tree was tied with a gauze so bees couldn't get to it, and the branch didn't yield one single fruit. Another branch with an exact equal number of blossoms was exposed to the bees, and it produced 33 pears. A melon is an example of exacting pollination process. The cantaloupe exists as a flowering stage one day, about 15 hours of sunlight. In order to produce a round, marketable melon, every single tubular in that bloom has to receive one or more grains of pollen from another flower in the same melon patch by a visit from a honeybee during that day. So if it doesn't, then a marketable melon is not produced. That means the honeybee must visit that blossom at least once every 15 minutes during 14 or 15 hours of sunshine in just one day, or you don't get a melon that is commercially acceptable and marketable that we would want to eat. We are a part of a fantastic ecosystem, a part of a fabulous creation. This marvelous world of ours is filled with many exciting examples of intricate, unseen laws in motion that act upon us, inside our bodies, and that dictate our happiness in life. You ought to write right now for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine. Also write for the booklet, Why Were You Born? You need to know whether or not humanity was created and put here on the earth by an intelligent and almighty creator for a definite purpose, and if so, what is that purpose, and why is all of humankind seemingly totally unaware of it? Were we foredestined to be born, to grow up, to have our hates and our loves, our fights and our heartbreaks, our disease and our good health, what little of it people can enjoy? Work and slave and sweat and strain to accumulate a certain amount of material goods, and then gradually grow into senility and final death, or maybe have our lives snuffed out by an accident or by disease. If you look at it biologically, you can't come to any other conclusion but that life is merely to be enjoyed as best you possibly can. Suffer as little as possible, accumulate as much as possible, and hope when you go, you can go peacefully. But there are emphatic answers this booklet will give you to a great purpose in your being. Are we just an evolutionary product which is going to be obliterated, and then there'll be some other kind of creatures to take over on the earth? You know, people sit around and speculate about that. And they hope, of course, that that'll happen sometime after their own lifespan is allotted. So what about their great-grandchildren? Well, let them take care of themselves, people seem to think. But this booklet gives you emphatic answers, one way or the other. You can expect surprises because it proves there is a great purpose being worked out. It shows you the tremendous difference between animal instinct and human mind. It shows you the difference between brain and mind. And it shows you, surprisingly enough, that creation is a process that is not right now complete. The title of the booklet is Why Were You Born? Why are you on the earth? Just request the booklet, Why Born? It's free of charge and no price if you write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.